Love Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions.
Today is
Let's
Thursday,
go.
April 25th, 2013, and we welcome you to the broadcast. Today, Homeopathy World Community Founder Debbie Brooke is traveling, dealing with family health issues out of state. She's not able to be with us today. We wish her and her family well and look forward to Debbie's return next week. But really good news for you folks. In about a half an hour from now, California attorney and monthly special guest on the virus show, VYRUS, that's Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., our monthly afternoon virus show here, attorney Greg Glazer from California will be with us. So stick around, folks. You'll want to see that. Greg is amazing. He does incredible research, not just basic standard legal research, but historical legal research, and provides background and framework for what it means to be the so-called democratic republic that we are, or at least were originally set up to be, and helps us to understand where we are in relation to what we originally set up in this nation intended to be, as there's so many complex ins and outs in current law and legal history, and Greg Glazer does an amazing job of helping us put all that in perspective. So stick around, folks. Greg will be with us in a little while. I'd like to remind you that this is a combined show. Previously, Virus was a radio show of Homeopathy World Community, initially set up by HWC founder Debbie Brooke and co-hosted by Debbie and myself. We're continuing that show, but here today in recent months, we're also combining that with Freedomizer Radio as a Freedomizer Radio show. So we have listeners from Homeopathy World Community and Freedomizer Radio. We are privileged and proud to be speaking to both audiences and welcome all of you again today. There was an interesting topic in the news, a vaccine topic in the news. It had to do with Oregon children who are going to be vaccinated against their parents' will. And someone had emailed me and said, would these parents be able to appeal this unconstitutional decision if an appeal fund was established? And I'm not going to try to comment on the specific case because it's just really hard to get the full story from an article on the internet or in any other media for that matter. On lawsuits, many times people who are passionate about one particular position on an issue will write an article from that perspective. But I want to talk about the underlying issue because there have been cases similar to this that have come up in different states, and the appellate courts or courts of appeal have gone different ways in terms of how they address these issues. And so the fundamental question here, I believe in the Oregon case, but certainly with the other cases, I'll talk about all of these kind of generally and collectively as well as somewhat individually, has to do with when does a parent's right to exercise a vaccine exemption end if the state intervenes for some reason having to do with claims of abuse or neglect. And you can, for example, in many, if not most or all states, you can potentially have your children taken away from you by the state if they, following proper rules, which are going to vary somewhat from state to state, but if there are accusations of abuse and neglect that are founded, in fact, if there's even a serious belief of the possibility of that, children can be removed temporarily until they find out whether or not the kids are safe to go back home. There's really extensive power in the hands of child protective agencies and social services, and I'm sure the vast majority of the time they have the best of intentions, but occasionally and maybe not so occasionally sometimes, children are actually removed from families, and they later find out, oops, there really wasn't any basis for doing that. Here, you can have your children back. But at that point, the emotional harm to the kids has already happened. It can be, and of course, the rest of the family, a severely traumatic sort of event. But in general principle, we want the state to be able to intervene if there's a genuine need for the safety and protection of the children. The question for our purposes today is, when the state does intervene, do the parents still get to exercise a religious exemption or other exemption, vaccine exemption for the children? Or does the state then, once they remove the children, have that authority? And we have to distinguish here between having your children taken away, which can be something that's a temporary step while they investigate to see whether or not there whether or not they can prove or substantiates the word they will typically use, whether they can substantiate the claims of neglect or abuse. And if they are substantiated, then things get really complicated in term, potentially anyway, in terms of what steps, if any, can the parents go through to get their kids back, and have they gone through the steps, and so forth. But in the meantime, this question about who gets to make the immunization decision, and you have to distinguish between losing your children and losing your parental rights. Those are two separate things. You can have your kids taken away from you by the state, but not lose your parental rights. And so in some cases, when children have been removed, in the few cases in legal precedent around the country, in some cases the parents can, and in other cases they can't make that decision. And I think for, let's take a more superficial look at the question, or the initial layer of the analysis, top layer of the analysis, if you will, I think it has to do first and foremost with the particular wording of each state's laws. First of all, under the U.S. Constitution, parents are presumed to be fit. This is the 14th Due Process Clause. And under the 14th Due Process Clause, parents are presumed to be fit and presumed to be making decisions that are in the best interest of their children, unless there's a showing to the contrary. And by showing to the contrary, what we usually mean is that there would have to be some court proceeding with a judge or someone in the position of a judge, the function of a judge, looking at evidence, and the parents having an opportunity to tell their side of the story. And if, after it's all said and done in a proper proceeding, the court has grounds for and rules that the parents are not fit, then the children can be taken away from the parents and put in the custody of the state or relatives or whomever the court in any given situation deems to be best suited for that. What's in the best interest of the children is typically what they'll be basing that kind of a decision on, what the options are and what's best for the kids. but again, that's a separate thing from whether you've actually lost your parental rights. Now, there can be a separate kind of proceeding. And again, the particular rules and procedures and boundaries will vary with the different wording in each state's laws. But this is, we are talking about, first of all, a state law issue for anybody who's a state resident in any event. Does the but the parents presumed to be fit until there's a showing. And unless there's a showing that the parent's unfit, then their decisions are presumed to be fit. And, of course, exercising an exemption, which is a state law right, is not something that somebody could be reasonably considered to. The exercise of a state law right could not be considered to be not in the best interest of a child, because if exercising an exemption right was not in the best interest of a child or was contrary to the best interest of a child, then the state legislature wouldn't have given us that option. The legislatures are presumed to have considered whether exercising an exemption is a reasonable and appropriate thing to do, and the enactment of exemption statutes, these exemption statutes carry with them a legal presumption that the exercise of that right is a reasonably safe thing to do, that it does not cause any significant health risk or concern for the child or anyone else, that it is not contrary to the best interests of the child, or again, we wouldn't they wouldn't have enacted it. So these are sound like sort of common sense ideas, but they're ones that courts often overlook because nobody gets to that place in their thinking, in their legal analysis, to present these ideas to the court. But I digress here. So there's different points here. So the children can be taken away, and I think this is what happened in the Oregon case, but they had not lost their parental rights. Well, if somebody hasn't lost their parental rights, shouldn't they still have the authority to exercise the exemption? And again, I think it boils down to, more so than not, what is the particular wording of each state's laws and what's the proper interpretation of those laws. So we had a case, a similar kind of case, a few years ago here in North Carolina, and parents lost custody of the kids to the state, did not lose their parental rights, and the question was who got to make the vaccine decision. Could the parents still exercise a religious exemption? And the appellate court here said that the state was. Now, to me, because of the wording of our law here, it was sort of a no-brainer, at least, again, the first layer of the analysis, because the law says, with the religious exemption law, if the parent or guardian or person in loco parentis, and that's just a Latin phrase meaning any person, or and here person could be the state, in the position of a parent. Well, if you take the children away from the family and the children are given to the state, then the state is in the position of a parent at that point. So it seems to me that the proper interpretation of the law here in North Carolina, not that I like the outcome, I don't, but under the state wording of the state law, that you could make the argument that the wording requires that the decision, once the children are placed in the custody of someone else other than the parents, it's that someone else that gets to make the decision. But in any case, that was how the case turned out. There was a case out west, and I think it was Arizona, where a mother lost custody of her children to the state, did not have her parental rights taken away, did not have her parental rights terminated. Again, separate issue, separate proceeding than simply having custody taken away. And there, the court decided that the mother could still exercise religious exemption. Again, I think it probably comes down to the wording of the laws. But I have, I take issue with all of this because the question, or a question, in all of these cases, is it has to do with what is the reach of the constitutional right to parent our children, the right and obligation. Now, there are few or probably no absolute rights. I mean, a parent does not have an absolute right to make any decision at any time about their children. If they make a decision that clearly hurts their child or puts their child at risk of imminent harm, then the parent, are vulnerable to having their custody taken away or having the state intervene in one way or another to protect the child, as we would hope the state could and would do in any legitimate instance where a parent is making seriously bad decisions or behaving in a manner that puts their child at any sort of serious risk. But anything short of that, the parents have not only the right to parent their children, but the obligation to take care of the children. And as between state and federal law, now we were first talking about, you know, whether you could lose your parental rights, whether you could lose custody of your children. For state law residents, these are all state law issues. It's not a federal law issue. It's first and foremost, anyway, fundamentally a state law issue. But we also have federal constitutional rights, this due process right to be presumed fit, unless shown otherwise, to be a fit parent, and the constitutional right to parent our children. And federal law is a higher legal authority than state law. So there are exceptions everywhere in law, but as a general proposition, when state and federal laws conflict, federal law wins. Federal law trumps the state law, or the more technically correct term is supersede. The federal law would supersede the state law when there's a conflict. So if there's a state law that says the state gets to make the vaccine decision, but if the parents have not lost their parental rights, they've only lost custody, do they not still have their federal constitutional rights? So that even if the state law says the state gets to make the decision, that you could argue, well, no, there's a higher law, a constitutional right, federal constitutional 14th Amendment due process right that says I'm fit to make a decision unless there's a showing otherwise. Well, maybe the removal of custody and the reasons for that are the evidence that the parents would be deemed not fit then under the 14th Amendment due process clause. But they have this right to parent our children. So there's a question here in my mind, and I pose it only as a question. I'm not really asserting necessarily an answer in any given instance. But the starting place is, what is the wording of the state law? What's the proper interpretation of that? And then there's a secondary question for me, which could potentially make the state law argument a moot point, sort of irrelevant, because the constitutional law is a higher legal authority. Does the parent, when does a parent lose their constitutional right? And I think they lose that right when there's a showing that they're unfit. But is, you know, are you unfit if you haven't lost your parental rights? Is fitness something that's temporary or maybe applied only to one particular topic area or decision? These are questions, the answers I don't have for you off the top of my head, and could vary from decisions from court to court. So it's an interesting question. It's a disturbing one for many of us, because if you really have engaged in behavior or failed to engage in proper behavior that's so extreme that you lose your parental rights, if you're taken to court by someone who has what's called standing, meaning they have the right to go into court and ask that your parental rights be terminated, and if the court sees that there's evidence to meet whatever each state's or any state's standard is for the loss of parental rights, and they're generally pretty high standards, you have to pretty much, I mean, it's going to vary from state to state, but you've got to abandon your child, be completely uninvolved, completely by your actions, completely pull yourself out of any connection with a child to subject yourself to being potentially losing your parental rights. So it's a pretty high standard. And do you, as long as you retain your parental rights, your fundamental parental rights, do you still have that constitutional right to parent your children, to make decisions for your children? And, you know, I don't know the answer. According to some of these cases, at least, not necessarily so. Maybe you can just have done something bad enough to lose custody, temporarily or otherwise, but have still retained your parental rights and still lose the ability to make decisions, the vaccine exemption decision for your children. So it's not, fortunately, it's not a situation that many of us find ourselves in. It's rather a small set of people who both lose custody of their children and are in a disagreement with the state about whether or not to exercise an exemption for their children. So fortunately, most of us are not going to be dealing with that kind of an issue. We cannot presume that we have the right to make those kinds of decisions once our children have been taken away, at least according to what some courts around the country have done with these cases. Well, let me see what else we've got here. I'm going to touch a little bit on some news issues. There's a recent article at Mercola.com that Dr. Mercola says this is a story that should serve as a wake-up call to all American parents. Currently making headline news, this particular story. And it has to do with a Staten Island kindergartner who was barred from attending school because she hadn't been vaccinated against chickenpox, even though her pediatrician refuses to vaccinate her on grounds that it may endanger the health of her baby sister. This is a really interesting issue here, because the laws for medical and religious exemptions vary from state to state, so the boundaries of those rights will similarly vary from state to state, and the way the law works, again, accordingly, vary from state to state. So with medical exemptions, this is a medical exemption story. With medical exemptions, in some states, the way the law is worded, if a doctor makes the recommendation, that's the end of the story. The child has the exemption. Everybody goes on about their way. Not true in other states. And I have to joke about this. It's not a joking matter, but sometimes you just, in this dark arena of vaccine policy and law, sometimes you have to find your humor where you can. You know, everybody knows that a bureaucrat sitting in an office in the state capitol knows more about what's best for your children than your children's pediatrician, right? So, of course, the state has to have the authority, apparently in New York anyway, to look at a doctor's recommendation for medical exemption and decide whether the doctor knows what they're doing. I suppose one could argue that there are the occasional doctors who will make a decision just to please the parent or the patient that really isn't medically sound, and so the state wants to have the option to look all of these over and decide which ones are really valid or not. But that just sort of assumes that no doctors are trustworthy. Now, I think a lot of doctors are misinformed, but I think the vast majority of them, as people everywhere, are generally, on the whole, good people, try to do the right thing. Many doctors may have bad information about vaccines in particular, for example, but they try to do the right thing. I mean, there's very few doctors who are deliberately deceitful. And this doctor made a medically sound decision whether or not any other given doctor would necessarily agree. And the problem here that we should all be really concerned about, and I think this is what Dr. Mercola is referring to when he says wake-up call here, is this is the state stepping in to tell you what's proper for you and your child in terms of health care. And this is just fundamentally wrong, folks. I'm not going to give you any legal mumbo-jumbo. This is just fundamentally, on a profound, simple, common-sense level, wrong. The state should not be stepping in to tell your doctor, to second-guess your doctor, if you wish to rely on your doctor, or your child's pediatrician, if you wish to rely on your child's pediatrician. But in New York and many other states, the state has authority to say, no, we don't care if a doctor recommends the exemption. We're going to, you know, reject it. I see this in the I saw this a lot this past fall and in the past in the healthcare arena, where nurses have a letter from a doctor that they take to the hospital administrator, the hospital where they work, and the administrator says, in effect, we don't care what your doctor says about you shouldn't get this flu vaccine. You're going to get it anyway or lose your job. And it's really disturbing. I had one nurse that actually had letters from three different doctors. She had enough different medical issues that she had three different doctors for three different kinds of medical problems. And all three of these doctors said you should not get a vaccine. They all three wrote letters, and the hospital still said, we don't care. You know, you don't meet our criteria. We know better about what you should do than, you know, all your medical doctors. This kind of intervention into our personal life is just fundamentally wrong. And we need to recognize what's going on and be concerned about it. Now, in New York State in particular, there's actually an appellate court case. It's a legal precedent where a doctor recommended an exemption for a child. The state rejected it. The parents sued. They took it to court, and they took it up on appeal, and the parents eventually lost. And in effect, what the case said was, the informal takeaway, let's call it, from the case. Because really what the court was looking at was whether or not the appellate court was looking at whether or not the court below had abused its discretion. I think it was some sort of abuse of discretion type of standard. So the appellate court wasn't actually ruling on the merits of the case. They were just looking to see whether the court below had followed proper procedure in effect. But the takeaway from the case for me was that there wasn't any published medical studies saying that this particular health condition meant that being vaccinated with the particular health condition that the child had was subjecting a child to a high risk of serious problems. In other words, there was no medical literature in evidence anyway that supported the doctor's opinion. And this reminds me of the really disturbing mentality, to use a simple metaphor, as we're not going to put a stoplight up at this intersection until at least there are at least 10 accidents or 3 people are killed because of accidents there. And when that happens, then we'll go put a stoplight up, rather than let's go put up a light, you know, before, let's use some other way to assess the risk here, high traffic, high speed or whatever, let's put up a light before people get hurt or killed. And it's the same kind of mentality here. We're going to keep injecting kids until, not only until one of them is hurt or killed who has this medical condition, but until somebody publishes a medical study validating that, showing that here with this condition is what happened when somebody got vaccinated, and so, you know, now nobody in the future should do that. That kind of mentality for something like vaccination, routine immunization, you know, if there were such a thing as a safe and effective vaccine, and if there were an immediate emergency, a highly virulent disease outbreak, epidemic or something, maybe you err on the side of caution favoring vaccines in such a hypothetical scenario, although I'm suspicious that one could ever exist because I'm suspicious about the whole theory of vaccination and whether or not they work, and we do have other more effective ways of dealing with infectious disease concerns that are they're more effective, a lot less costly, and don't have the side effects of injury and death that vaccine do. So I'm not sure such a situation could ever genuinely even occur, but maybe if such a situation could occur, we'd have something there to go with. The time is flying by here. We're closing in on the end of the first half hour. I see my dear friend and colleague, attorney Greg Glazer, on the line here. We're going to go to a break, probably be something on the order of give or take 4 minutes or so, and we'll be back on the other side of that. We'll bring Greg Glazer on, and folks, you don't want to miss the next hour and a half here with Greg, because it always moves quickly with lots of great information and analysis and discussion. So stay with us, folks. And I am going to see if I can find the ads here to get us moving into that part of the show. And we will be back in just a few minutes.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Antiwarteeth.com is to promote anti-war activism, unlocking minds and shattering paradigms. By purchasing one of these t-shirts, you become an anti-war activist. www.antiwarteeth.com, bringing peace and human rights to the mainstream. Buy it, wear it, become it. Anti-War Teeth.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing.
Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait. There's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Get ready for the epic new documentary adventure ride of your life. Shade, the motion picture. A view into the globalist domain and embellish in Burma's film.
Nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. Governments do not operate the way you think they do. Banks do not do what you think they do. The police department is not here for what you think it is. Nothing in your world works the way you think it does.
We are going to let them know that their world government has been identified, and they thought they just cloned the world economy to bring in a worldwide police state, but instead, it's going to bring them down.
You have to stand up. Speak up. Speak out.
Shade the motion picture. Order your copy of the DVD today at ShadeTheMotionPicture.com.
I am an autonomous government agent here to steal your livelihood.
Not so fast. I'm Sovereign Filing Solutions.
And I'm the Sovereign. We're teamed up.
To bring you...
the truth without censorship.
Are you tired of being fed multi-million dollar media lies?
Are you ready for the real story?
Sovereign Filing Solutions has teamed up with the Sovereign newspaper to make sure you get it.
And not the BS this guy behind me wants to feed you.
Take the step, help make the change.
Oh, come on, that's not even fair. How are we supposed to rule indiscriminately if you know what's going on?
Hello everyone, Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house. And Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants. I just love the taste of it. And this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silver Leaf Tea, it's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silver Leaf Tea.
We are back. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-host, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. That's me. Our regular co-host, Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook, is not able to be with us today. But I am very pleased to say we have California attorney Greg Glazer with us. Greg, how are you doing today?
Hey, Alan. How are you? I was just listening to the first half of the show and getting a lot of very interesting information, especially about parental rights. I really just want to congratulate you for the work that you're doing and express my appreciation.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. I was thanking myself earlier today as I was getting ready for the show how pleased I am to count myself a colleague of yours because I have always been and continue to be impressed with the research and insights. And in particular, I'm fascinated with the historical perspective that you so frequently bring to these issues, something that I have never found myself with the time to sort of dig around it and figure out, and yet it is so fundamental to where we are because everything we do and have and are now sits on this underlying historical context. And so... glad to have you show and impressed to hear about all that.
Cool. Yeah, the historical context can really add a lot to the constitutional discussion, even if it's just like little factoids, like when the writ of habeas corpus was being discussed at the time of the Constitutional Convention, and the authors never even contemplated that there could be an emergency going across all of the states all at once. You know, because they weren't thinking about, you know, telephones, obviously, and an international economy. It just it wasn't even discussed. Knowing that, it helps frame how courts today analyze these issues. And then in the last half hour, you brought up a very, very interesting topic. And you actually provided more information than is currently being discussed online. Because I was recently researching this topic of when of how different state courts can strip parental rights, and then where the states then make medical decisions on behalf of the parents because the parent because the state's now in loco parentis, as you said, or parens patriae is another way to say it. And the information that I found, I was just about to go verify it, was that only the state of Arizona protects the right of the parent to continue making medical decisions even after they lose custody. But I needed to go verify that. It looks like you've done more research in that area, pulling up appellate cases. So we should definitely plan to powwow on that and share research.
Well, my insight is pretty narrow, Greg. It's really limited to the vaccine exemption question, although, of course, it's and what I find pretty much across the board is that the vaccine issue is just different from other issues. Now, I'm not sure if it is on this exact point or not, but and it all seems to hinge from this what you and I, of course, are very clear, and probably our listeners, this mistaken notion of the herd immunity theory, the idea that your vaccine protects other people, so vaccination is, therefore, you don't get to decide what goes into your body because you have to join the collective here and, you know, and protect everybody else. And, I mean, I'm convinced it's just it's really an economic theory. Underneath the wording there is, and what really is going on is, this is how we can make everybody do it whether they want to or not and sell more vaccines, you know, and there may be other agendas underneath that one, but even if we look no further than the fall of the money, you can see where it comes from. But that's this mentality, and so, you know, someone could argue, although when you look at what's going on with GMO labeling, for example, this is not so much just limited to vaccines, but some of the way that vaccines get handled. We would hope, for example, even though I'm not sure this is happening in the real world in terms of the, to date, many failed efforts to get labeling laws for GMOs on the books, but theoretically, you know, you get to decide what you eat or don't eat, and theoretically nobody's going to make a big issue or deal out of that. But with vaccines, oh no, vaccines are different because your vaccine is protecting other people, so we are going to tell you that you have to vaccinate. And I just see in the vaccine arena, like if I'm looking at like vaccine custody disputes, not the exact same topic we were just talking about, but it's a related one. You know, the legal arguments that I see in that arena and that I discuss when I talk with family law attorneys around the country, I share legal arguments for them that are unique to vaccines, reasons why you can't approach those cases, and not if you want to win anyway, from and arguably as a legal matter, why you can't, even if you want to, approach these cases under a standard state law best interest of the child approach, which is what every other custody case, most if not every other custody case, is looked at under this best interest of the child standard. But if you go in with vaccines under a best interest of the child standard, the courts are going to say, well, the health authorities, majority of doctors, the state health departments, and the CDC, they all say vaccines, you know, win, and so that's what courts typically are gonna rule. So you have to find some way to take it out of that standard if you want to have a chance of winning those cases. But well, let me reel myself in here for a second, Greg. Yeah. Where would you like to steer us from here?
Oh, sure. Well, I thought we could do an overview of the right to medical freedom and essentially where it comes from and how it's applied today. So, for example, the question would be, if a government agent comes knocking on your door and insists that you submit your person to a medical test to determine if you have a contagious disease, what are you supposed to do? You know, it's an interesting legal question, and you may find yourself in a situation where you don't have the opportunity to have a lawyer there for you. And I think that's probably the most likely situation for someone for this to come up, if they are well informed, you know. And I think probably Freedomizer Radio would be directed toward people who already are very well informed about the New World Order and vaccines and, you know, things along those lines. And so they already know not to, you know, inject themselves with formaldehyde, for example. And so the only time that they're going to have an interaction on that level with authorities would be probably in an emergency setting. And so there are certain things that you can do to help protect yourself in advance, and one of them is knowing your legal rights. Now, one thing to know up front is that there's no magic, you know, legal card, legal saying you can say. Like, you can't just recite the Fifth Amendment and then expect the government agent to let you remain in peace. rather,
yeah, let me jump in just for a second on that point, Greg, because I really want to underscore that. I started getting calls back in 2009 with the unveiling of the so-called swine flu pandemic, calls from people around the country, and they were saying, what do I do? You know, how do I avoid this vaccine if it's mandated? And I just hadn't had the question of the emergency context come up before, so perhaps to my at least minor embarrassment, I didn't have answers. And so when I started looking into this and I realized that in the context of a declared emergency, rights can change. And basically what a conclusion I came to was that in terms of just sort of a formal legal analysis, I wasn't finding anything, just as you're saying. There's no, you know, you pull out this card and that's your get out of vaccine free card. I don't know, maybe we should print up some of those. But now that I think about it, that would be pretty entertaining. Maybe we should sell those as a gag but fundraising effort there. But anyway, what I found myself saying to people, the subsequent callers, as I started looking into this, when they said, how do I avoid this shot, I found myself saying, the way you avoid a shot in that situation is that you do everything you can now to avoid ever being in that situation, because I don't see an easy out in that situation. Now, I'm not saying there isn't one. But please go on, because this is a topic I would love to a line of thought here I'd love to develop and hear where you want to take us with it.
Sure. Yeah. There's two avenues. There's the legal avenue and the practical avenue. The legal avenue starts with you have this officer and they're at your door and they're asking you to submit to a test. Now, the first thing that a lawyer would do is they would analyze jurisdiction and say, well, who is this officer? Where does their authority come from? Is it the, you know, Department of Health Services? Is this a local sheriff? You know, and then they would look to the underlying statute that authorizes this action. Is it under the Stafford Act, you know, and so forth? But a layman who doesn't have a lawyer there is not going to know that. And so what they would do is just do a general objection to the test on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment, or the right to be free in your person, papers, and property. Now, the first is the right to be free in your person. There's also a rule, a United Nations rule, that the United States accepts by treaty that says that you have the right to be free in your person as well. You have a right to health freedom. And the Supreme Court recognizes this as well. So that would be the first thing to do, is just assert your right. And when you assert a right, you generally do it in a friendly manner. It's the most effective way to do it. You know, it may seem very antagonistic when you have this person, you know, this authority figure at your door who is asking you to submit to a forceful test. But I can tell you, after having watched so many videos online and read so many cases, that the worst thing you can do is make the situation worse by raising your voice, being angry, things like that. Just be confident, be civil about it. If you are civil and polite, you can expect to receive civil and polite on the opposite end. Now, obviously, that might not happen, but it is the best strategy, and it promotes law and order. And really,
give you the best chance of having a civil exchange, even if ultimately that doesn't occur.
And you know, the ultimate goal here is to promote law and order. Because law and order is on the side of freedom in America. It may not seem like it, but if you read some Supreme Court cases, you'll be maybe pleasantly surprised at the amount of law and order that we really have here. It is. I'm constantly impressed, especially some of these hard-fought freedoms that came out of different eras that were tumultuous, like, you know, the Civil Rights era, for example. Just as a leave that aside for later. But, okay, so when this authority figure is asking you to submit to the test, and then you raise the issue, you say, I have a right to be free in my person's property and papers, and this is a right to health freedom, and then they would say, well, here's my order, you know, that allows me to do this. And then at that point, they still insist that you have to request that you can see your attorney. Now, it didn't used to be like this. If you go back far enough in the States, it used to be that when an epidemic or a pandemic was declared, that you would be put into quarantine And then only later would you have the right to challenge it. And that challenge was always made by way of what was called a habeas corpus petition. But now these things are handled through statutory schemes. And so essentially what you can do is you just assert your right to counsel, and you just make it very clear that you are going to continue to be peacefully natural in your home, and that you'll self-quarantine in your home if necessary until you can speak with your doctor and with your attorney. And then you can actually, from the sanctity of your home, you can make your attorney, your professional, can make your petition, your due process petition, to be free from testing. Now, the standards under which that hearing will take place will depend on the statute at issue. So, for example, there are different emergency laws throughout the nation, different emergency power laws, like I mentioned the Stafford Act before. And whatever declaration is made will depend on what procedures are in place. But generally, you're going to have the state has the burden to prove by what's called clear and convincing evidence that you have that you are a threat in some way. So, and they're also, based on precedent, they're allowed to rely on social evidence. So what, an example would be there was a case where a woman was caught in a hotel room in the 50s having sex with a man who was not her husband. And so she was presumed to be a prostitute. And the question was whether she could be tested for a venereal disease, because based on her social pattern, it wasn't that they had any evidence, you know, that she actually had a venereal disease, other than just she seemed to fit this pattern of being in a hotel room with a man who was not her husband. And knowing that, you know, that a court may look at that evidence, you know, you want to be able to present evidence that you are not a threat. And so the best evidence that you can have is testing by your own doctor. So if you can just have, you know, your own doctor come to your home and give you a physical examination on the doctor's terms, and again, this is going to be your family doctor, then you're in a much better position because you're compiling evidence. Now you're not in a quarantine situation, because once you get processed by the system, it's really difficult to get out. And this is something that we attorneys see quite a bit. You know, we're often called into a situation when things have already gone south, and then we're asked to try to fix it. And we just think, gosh, if I could only go back 6 months and being able to counsel this person right at the outset, it would have been so helpful. You probably see that quite a bit too, Alan.
Yeah. The hardest folks for me to help are the ones who have tried an exemption on their own, get rejected, and then they come to me, and it's like, oh, these are all the things I would have told you not to do if you had come to me up front. And I don't say this in a condescending, meaning to be condescending at all. It's very reasonable for people, especially because of how expensive attorneys are, for people to try things on their own. It's just that the law is more complicated than most people realize, and many times people end up spending a lot of money trying to get on an attorney to who's trying to help them get out of a situation that they could have avoided altogether if they'd just done a simple consultation with an attorney up front. But it's not always obvious to people. In fact, I would say probably far more often than not, it is not obvious to people or clear to people when they're in a situation that they really should consult an attorney before doing anything. And I guess I'll just say, in the simplest way I can respond to that sort of general issue in the broader sense, is if it's something that involves law or legal rights, and if it's very important to you, whatever it's about, consider talking with an attorney just to avoid being in a situation where you get into a situation that you could have avoided, and that's hard to get out of, that maybe you could have avoided if you got onto an attorney up front. But, I see that a lot. But I'm happy to say that in this particular arena with vaccine exemptions and waivers, it's more common for me in my practice, believe it or not, Greg, that people do come to me up front, and they say, I want to make sure I don't, you know, screw anything up here. What's the right way to do this, or best way to do this? So in terms of the people that come to me, it is more often up front than after the fact.
Yeah, And we can take a look at history to try to put a trend or projection on where on what the future holds. And the history of epidemics in the United States, there are many. One law review article I can direct you to if you're interested in the law and facts is Felice Batlin wrote a law review called Law in the Time of Cholera, Disease, State Power, and Quarantine, Past and Future, the 2007 from Temple Law Review. And she discusses the history of quarantine powers, and especially through the example of the cholera outbreak in New York around 1892. And then she also talks about current U.S. policy that basically endorsed military action to enforce quarantine. So what you have is you have a historical background and then projecting that into the future to see how, you know, what trends are, what precedent is. And what she found is that history cautions that we cannot depend on the courts to impute adequate due process and substantive rights into federal or state quarantine law. In the past and continuing well into the present, courts too often have deferred to the authority of health officials, close quote. So what we're looking at there is a review where the public health officials tend to respond to cholera outbreaks in a way that is almost overprotective. Like they will issue very like sweeping orders. For example, you know, one of the orders was to be temperate in your food and drink because they just didn't know. You know, they didn't know. You know, cholera was spread because of a lack of hygiene. I mean, that's so important when you look at these epidemics. And today it's a new ballgame because there are these viruses can be manufactured in labs, in military labs, and likely are. And so they're spread not necessarily by lack of hygiene, but by people having a poor immune system. And so the thing that you can do is, you know, to protect yourself is know right off the bat that courts are likely to be very deferential to public health authorities. And so that means that whatever evidence is compiled by the public health authorities will be given great weight. So knowing that, you're going to have a duty to produce your own evidence. How are you going to produce evidence? You know, the best evidence is not going to be from, your own mouth. It's going to be from the report of your own doctor who does a review. It's going to be scientific evidence. The best evidence is that you have a healthy immune system. When that person ends up knocking at your door, you don't have scabs all over your face, but rather you have already chosen a lifestyle where you are doing things like eating organic, maintaining, you know, your own cupboard filled with natural remedies to make sure that you are living in a manner that is not going to present evidence that you have been subject to infectious disease. And it's really the best protection. So law and practice go hand in hand in this example. And I could just, you know, go through all sorts of examples where the states had were faced with these epidemics, you know, like yellow fever that raged New York and Philadelphia. And then these things go on for years, and they were such a major part of early American heritage and history. It's virtually forgotten today and almost not even discussed. But people were incredibly afraid of these diseases and were very willing. Public opinion was massively in favor of whatever public health officials were saying was going to be good for the public. Now, it's funny because there's a hypocrisy to it as well. Like, even though public opinion is in favor of these public health measures, on an individual level, people don't want them to apply to themselves. It's like, 95% of the population will be in favor of public health measures, but only, 80% are willing to submit to them, you know? And so you found that some people would prefer to run to the hills, as they did in some examples. I brought that example up many times in New York where there was an epidemic, and they were, you know, issuing these quarantine orders for people to stay in their homes, and people just said, forget this, I'm going to my vacation home out in upstate New York. And that's just what they did. And so there's what public health authorities have found is that they're really just playing the percentages. They issue these orders for people to stay indoors. They issue orders for people to submit to mandatory testing. They issue orders that, with regard to the quarantine of foods and quarantine of water and stuff like that. But they know not everyone's going to comply. They're just hoping for a sufficient compliance percentage rate so that they can lessen the epidemic overall. And they're just trying to ride it out. because they know that these things don't go away overnight. And so they're just trying to do the best that they can, which is another reason to really work with public health authorities to promote law and order the best way that you can. And the best way to do that is, again, you just assert your right, to be peaceful and natural in your home. Protect yourself with natural remedies and organic food, and hope for the best. Now, there's certain things that you can do in the process. There are certain extra steps that you can take that will add to the credibility of your argument if you do really intend to assert an exemption. So let's take an example. There is lots of claims that there is a bird flu, okay? And there will be remedies for that bird flu. Vaccines, a bird flu vaccine. And then if you know what goes into those bird flu vaccines, for example, formaldehyde and mercury and, the list of adjuvants that are in garden variety vaccines. Well, then what you can do is, knowing that ahead of time, just go to your doctor and say, look, is it a good idea for me to put formaldehyde in my body? He'll say no. I say, well, can you sign off on that for me, and just, give me some piece of paper that I can have in my medical file that shows that I shouldn't be putting this into my body. And then that way, if somebody ever does come knocking on your door, saying, hey, here's your shot. Well, you already have a piece of paper handy, so you don't have to worry about trying to contact your doctor during the course of an emergency to get that done.
Let me jump in here, if I may, Greg. It's a really interesting point, because one of the questions that goes on in my mind as I'm listening to your talking is, I can imagine the person who shows up at the door is not a decision maker. It's a foot soldier, so to speak, following orders. And so I can imagine someone coming up with the expectation that whatever they tell you, you're going to passively comply with, because they have orders, health department order or whatever it is, and they don't want anybody to mess up their day by trying to come up with something that they're not authorized or don't know how to handle or not authorized to handle. So I could just imagine someone, the person at the door coming up saying, we've been ordered to give everybody a vaccine, and you say, well, I have religious objections, or, and I have a constitutional right to refuse, or whatever, somebody says, and they say, well, and you're real polite, and maybe they are real polite, and they say, that's fine, but, my orders don't say anything about that, so I have to go ahead and give you this vaccine. And the question in my mind then becomes, well, how do you engage I'm going to sort of narrow the question here for the hypothetical instance where somebody says, these are my orders and that's all I'm authorized to do, so anything else you say is irrelevant to me, these are the orders. And how do you engage that person in a conversation or interaction that enables them to consider something other than the narrow order that they understand? And what they're really saying, when they're saying, here are the orders, I'm not authorized to do anything else, what they're really saying is, my butt's on the line if I don't do my job correctly. So in my mind, I'm thinking, if there's some way you can convince them that not doing what you want will also put their butt on the line, in other words, because these people probably want to do the right thing, but at the end of the day, this is a job, and they don't want to get penalized or fired or anything for not doing their job right, And so how do you convince them that they may get in trouble if they don't do what you want is sort of, I guess, my thinking. And so let me stop myself there and ask if you have any thoughts, first of all, about just sort of the general concept I'm presenting there, and does that have any relationship to some of the things that you have said or maybe are leading up to in terms of what people can do, when someone comes to the door and says, here's your option A, and you say, I want option B. And let me just add another quick point here. We're near a break time, so go ahead and give us an answer there, but let me know when you can get to a pause there for break, and we'll go ahead and take care of that and then get right back to you.
So the first preface is that no statement we make here today should be taken out of context. What we're doing is we're presenting strategies for law and order. The idea is we want you to consult your doctor, we want you to consult your lawyer, and to make sure that when you are interacting with public health authorities that you are promoting law and order. This is not a way to find loopholes in the law and stuff like that. So that's the preface. And then it's key to keep in mind that the fear of these diseases is so high that you want to be recognizing the importance of being deferential to these public officers. That they're going to be under stress too, and they don't want to hear a bunch of legal mumbo jumbo from somebody who probably doesn't know who probably hasn't even read these cases anyway. I have the hardest time finding anyone who's even read the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And so you want to be very respectful in that regard. And the best way to be respectful is to be first off, you got clean, organic food, natural remedies. You want to be orderly. Have your medical papers ready. Be sure that you've already consulted with your doctor. You have a family doctor, and then know that you are going to have some rights, no matter what emergency is applied. You're always going to have some rights. It's like imagine a sliding scale. If it's a Stafford Act declaration, think maybe military tribunal. If it's a governor declaration of emergency, maybe that you'll be able to go into superior court. If it's absolute martial law, well, then at least you have habeas corpus. And you can sort of find out these things or make a list of them in advance, put them with your medical file if you like. That's a good break.
All right. Well, fascinating, Greg. Fascinating as always. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips and special attorney guest Greg Glazer from California. We are going to go to break here. It'll be another 4 or so minutes, and we'll be back for another hour of the show. Stick with us, folks. Lots more good stuff to come.
Want to spread awareness to your neighbors, family, and friends about what is going on in our country today? It may be things you already know, like the large number of FEMA camps spread around this country to lock up citizens like you and me, what legislators are doing to strip states and people of their sovereign rights, or legislation giving states the power to force vaccinate under a declared state of emergency. Do your neighbors understand what is going on? William Lewis Films offers the perfect tools to inform our population about this government's tyrannical shift from a constitutional republic to a despotic democracy. Films like 911 Ripple Effect, Beyond Treason, One Nation Under Siege, Washington You're Fired, Camp FEMA, Enemy of the State, Don't Tread on Me, Blood of Patriots, The Ron Paul Uprising, even 911 in Plain Sight, William's first production, are all available at williamlewisfilms.com. Get your DVDs today at williamlewisfilms.com. Educate against the police state.
We are so pleased to announce ESP Botanicals is now sponsoring Freedomizer Radio. They have a bath and body line of products made for keeping your skin beautiful and healthy, but it's also for psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, and dermatitis treatment. They are meticulously prepared skincare products made from the best botanicals available. Committed to buying only from the growers when they can and using the highest quality cold-pressed oils, botanical organic additives, the best steam-expressed essential oils, and the least processed carrier oils that are available in today's marketplace. Pamper yourself or someone special in your life. Give the gift of beautiful, glowing skin. ESPBotanicals.com. Thank you so much for supporting us at Freedomizer Radio.
Hello again, Freedomist. Proof is here, and I want to talk to you about a brand new soda maker called SodaStream. Now, the Proof House has had SodaStream for about a year, and we love the thing. We use it quite often. With SodaStream, you can have fresh-made soda in seconds. One of the big things we like about it is that there's no high-fructose corn syrup and no aspartame. There's over 60 flavors, or you can create your own. Not just sodas, they also have iced teas and energy drinks. Here at the Proof House, we make egg cream sodas all the time. Some other facts to consider here, there's no electricity, no more wasted bottles and cans, and the most important thing is that it tastes great. Keep in mind, too, this is a perfect family present for Christmas, or, hey, just surprise the family with something great. Also, for a limited time, there's free shipping, so go to freedomizerradio.com and look for the SodaStream link, and I hope you check out the product. That's SodaStream right on freedomizerradio.com. Hey, guys, Proof here. Guess what? I just got a cell phone. Hey, for everyone that knows me, I'm not a fan of cell phones, but I just signed up with a company called SolarBay. And SolarBay is offering a plan right now with unlimited phone, text, and web for only $49 a month. Plus, if you refer a friend or two, you get a discounted rate for everyone you refer for as long as they have SolarBay, not just for the first month, but for the whole time that person has SolarBay. You sign up enough people, and SolarBay pays you every month. What other cell phone company is going to pay you for service? Anyway, go to solavei.com/freedomizer. That's Solavei, SolaveiBEI.com/freedomizer. Learn all about it. Plus, and another kicker, if you sign up three people under you, you'll get another month for free as well. Plus, they're going to pay you cash. Anyway, solavei.com/freedomizer.
Well, we're back. This is Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips, special monthly guest, Attorney Greg Glazer. Greg, where did we leave off?
Well, we left off at a nice break point and a good springboard to talk in, to talk about the overview of your right to be peacefully natural. I also mentioned the United Nations and thought I could follow up on that. There was a group of 31 experts in international law, and they convened in 1984 in Syracuse, Italy, and they developed what's called the Syracuse Principles. And these are recognized as international law principles. And here's one of them that relates to what we're talking about today. Quote: "No state party shall, even in time of emergency threatening the life of the nation, derogate from the covenant's guarantees of the right to life, freedom from scientific experimentation without free consent. These rights are not derivable under any conditions, even for the asserted purpose of preserving the life of the nation." Isn't that interesting? Here you have 31 lawyers, experts in international law, and they all agreed that even the right of the nation to preserve itself still is lesser than an individual's right to life and freedom. You know, it's this idea, and I wrote about this in my memo for the Pandemic Response Project. Go to pandemicresponseproject.com, and you'll see it. And the principle is that in a republic or a free society, there are some things that the government can't do. Like, for example, everyone knows they cannot have absolute power. They cannot make a law that says that it is illegal to be it's illegal to sleep, for example. You know, because sleeping is, it's a natural and peaceful human condition, and you can't stop someone from sleeping. It just, it naturally happens. Or it's like saying you can't be you can't have blue eyes. You know, a person who has blue eyes, they have no way to avoid punishment. It's like they're guilty without doing anything. And this is, that's what being natural is. That's what being unvaccinated means. You are natural. They may say it's unvaccinated, you know, or a threat, but it's not it. It's free, peaceful, and natural. That's what that person is. And so it's recognized in the United States and under international law that this right transcends even the right of a nation to preserve its own existence. So I find that fascinating, you know, and history judges these groups, these regimes that try to break with these principles. They just don't survive. Like, you know, the famous example is the Nazis, of course. You know, they had so many legal authorities, you wouldn't believe it. They used to issue from their courts and the Fuhrer, you know, they used to justify gassing humans, and they used to justify this stuff in their rules. But those aren't, that's not law. That's just an order. A law derives its legal authority from its virtue, not its mere issuance. You know, when Hitler goes and says, you know, all Jewish people are property, that's not law. It's just an order from a particular dictator who happens to be in power at the time. But that power that he has is always kept in check by greater powers, and the greater power is the power of the people, it's the power of nations, to keep that particular dictator, that particular regime in check, because no one is allowed to have absolute power. As long as we recognize the right of freedom, that there is something special about the human condition, as long as we see that, we will never let anyone have absolute power. And the ability to say that, you know, someone is not allowed to be peaceful or natural is exactly that. It's an absolute power over the human body. And so what I did is I took the time to prepare a proposed rule for defining peacefully natural. What is your view of it, Alan? What does peacefully natural mean to you?
Well, boy, and you have talked about this, of course, so many times, and in on one level it seems sort of self-evident and obvious, and yet at the same time when you say, what does it mean, and I try to find words for it, I have to give some thought to it. But I think on the kind of at first brush here, it would be the right to be peacefully natural, or being peacefully natural means being who you are, being able to be, allowed to be who you are and do what you're doing, provided it does not have any significant imposition or intrusion on someone else's right to be peacefully natural. I don't know if I'm using words to define themselves there, are moving in the direction.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, any less freedom than being able to do whatever you want to, as long as it does not impose on somebody else's, on somebody else. I mean, we can split hairs about lines and definitions and so forth, but just as sort of a broad sweeping concept for a starting place, that we should be free to do anything we want to do or refuse to do anything we don't want to do, so long as we're not imposing on other people's same right. And there just are all kinds of potential subtleties and nuances when you get into specific acts or behaviors or requirements or prohibitions.
And the law benefits when we try to apply our rules to facts. You know, when we have all these case precedents, it helps us use our logic to be able to prove that we're acting correct. And if we find that a case just doesn't work, then the case gets overturned. Because when we write these rules, like, for example, you know, the phrase peacefully natural or the phrase due process, you know, it really doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it doesn't mean anything until you apply it. You know, I could say due process, you know, to some tribal member in Africa, and they'd be like, what are you talking about? It wouldn't make any sense. But if I started giving them examples about how, you know, a police officer comes into the home, but they first need a warrant, you know, and then it starts, you know, they start to piece it together. And that's what cases do. They help flesh it out. And
I think it's important for listeners to understand that, you know, I run into a similar sort of thing all the time, Greg, when I'm talking with people about our First Amendment right to religious freedom. The First Amendment has, among other things, what's called the Free Exercise Clause that refers to the free exercise of religion, but it doesn't say anything about vaccines or any other specific religious issue or context, for that matter. And the thing that people need to understand is that we don't get to decide how this general concept applies to specific situations. It's the courts that decide that, and our task, if we choose to understand what our rights are, is to find out what the courts have said about how, for example, how does the Free Exercise Clause apply to vaccine religious exemptions? Because there are few, if any, rights that are absolute. They're all bounded by other opposing rights. And historically, our right to refuse vaccines for religious use a religious exemption as an example. Our right to refuse vaccines for religious reasons has always been bounded by the state's right to say, oops, never mind, because the situation now is too serious for you to be able to refuse vaccines, so now you need to get a vaccine or be quarantined or, you know, potentially leave the area or whatever. There's always this sort of balancing act to one degree or another, and the question becomes where are the boundaries and who gets to decide and in what situation? And
yeah.
we look, at least as a starting place, attorneys look to the legal precedent. What have the courts said in actual court cases that were similar to whatever issue we're looking at, you know, presently? So I just want to sort of clarify that for listeners, because I, you know, we sort of take for granted sometimes as attorneys a lot of fundamental legal concepts that our listeners sometimes are not necessarily clear about. So that's, you know, when we talk about, well, here's what such and such a case said, that's because we're trying to get clarification on what is the law.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the ways that we attorneys become confident in our practice areas, like, you know, I practice real estate, for example, is because we read law reviews and we read treatises, we read cases in our area, and we just see these principles confirmed over and over again under different facts that I just, you know, they just become these hard rules. But certain phrases become, are so inherently ambiguous, they will just lead to countless cases. Like, I did a paper once on this provision in CERCLA called owner and operator that established liability for a hazardous waste site. And the terms were so ambiguous that Congress used, you just had, you know, a list of cases. It was something like, I think I read through, I can't even remember how many cases I read through, but in the annotated code, there was like 300 cases just covering this one term. And so when I propose that we have this law that says that you have an absolute right to be peacefully natural, and then I try to define it, I know because of my experience that if I don't define this thing, it's going to be ambiguous and difficult. But even if I do define it, it's still going to be ambiguous because the nature of the terms are. And it will never really be well-defined until you have people disputing over it, which is interesting because we tend to think of law bringing, you know, law and order and harmony, but really law is the product or the sum of two people who disputed some logical outcome. Law is where somebody wanted one thing or somebody was in control of something, and another person wanted control over it, wanted to change that outcome. And that's why the law exists, to be able to resolve that dispute. And there wouldn't be a dispute if it was obvious. And so, but this is one of those obvious things where you can't make a law against someone having blue eyes, for example. We all know that. It's so intuitive to us. And but here I'm trying to define it. And so it's funny, Alan, you know, the words that you use to define peacefully natural, I use very similar words. I wrote, this is a short quote. Quote, the only absolute right of the individual is to be peacefully natural, which is a manner of being that causes no actual material or unjust harm or individually calculable material and unjust threat to another living being, and which is a fundamental expression of the individual human condition. Close quote. And it's a mouthful, you know, and it took me a while to find the right words.
But well said, Greg. You know, I was speaking in much more general to vague terms there, and I really like your word choice there. Would you read that for us again? Because it was a bit of a mouthful, but I thought it was very well stated. I'd love to hear that again, please.
Yeah. Quote, the only absolute right of the individual is to be peacefully natural, which is a manner of being that causes no actual material or unjust harm or individually calculable material and unjust threat to another living being, and which is a fundamental expression of the individual human condition. And so what we have there is two different aspects of the individual. One is that he cannot actually cause harm or cause material and unjust harm, and he can't even threaten something that's materially an unjust threat. And so if I were, you know, a Hitler, for example, I might say that, you know, anyone who even threatens potentially with a contagious disease is I have to be able to, you know, quarantine them and lock them down, you know, just on the risk. Like, I wouldn't do things like allow them to self-quarantine and provide access to natural remedies. No. I'm going to stockpile weapons, stockpile magazines, you know, stuff like that. So when we look at, you know, what a court would say is an unjust threat, you know, or they're probably going to look and be deferential toward the consensus of public health authorities. So if public health authorities say, that every single person on the planet, every living being is a threat just by the very nature of breathing, because it's a, you know, a disease that can be passed through, you know, breath, let's say, then right there you have a you have a situation where no one has any particular absolute right, because no, the individual, there is no such thing as being peacefully natural that no one can interfere with, because everyone's a threat. So wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. Well, and you know, you raise a really good point though here, though, that you're very careful in your word choice, and I thought effective. And yet, no matter how careful we are in definitions, sort of inherent to law, when you're at least many kinds of laws, when you're looking for wordings for laws, you're, to one degree or another, what you're really trying to do, at least ideally, in the hypothetical ideal, is to set a boundary for a hypothetically infinite variety of future situations and circumstances that could arise within the boundary of the law or definition that you're proposing or here or drafting. And I'm speaking just for general terms with law generally. And, of course, as a practical matter, that would be virtually, if not literally, impossible. And so this is, of course, one of the key roles of courts, is where people come up with situations where they might very reasonably disagree about what is the proper interpretation of a law for this situation and where are the lines and so forth. And we have courts, when those kind of disputes become formal anyway, we have, you know, courts give us the answers to that. But there's always going to be now there's you know, good faith interpretation, and then there's not so good faith interpretation where there's an underlying political or other personal or private agenda, and that gets into politics. You know, you're talking before about you know, we all at this day and age recognize that to outlaw having blue eyes would be absurd and absolutely not appropriate, and yet we have had societies and dictators in the not too distant past, maybe even some currently around the world, who do or attempt to do something, you know, more or less as ridiculous as that. We have currently in the U.S. recently and currently some rather, I think, bizarre things going on with introduction and passing of laws. For example, just one quick off-the-cuff example we've talked about here before, that California and North Carolina, our respective states, coincidentally, both have laws allowing children to consent to vaccines. You know, it seems like that not only sort of doesn't pass the common sense test, I don't think it passes at all the formal constitutional analysis or test. And yet legislatures are doing it. So it really is critical for us to understand our rights and where the boundaries are and where they're clear or not clear, as the case may be, but to recognize also that sometimes human beings, ultimately, whether deliberately or not in any given instance, will cross those boundaries. And then I think it's up to us, the responsibility then falls to us, to decide whether or not we're going to do something about that. And so, I mean, how do you feel? Because I know we've talked a little more in, I think, theoretical terms here, although you certainly mentioned early on today, Greg, there's the legal and the practical. And what do you think are some of the practical considerations or responsibilities that go with us as citizens to, first of all, be aware of our rights, be aware when those rights are ignored or walked over in some way or another? And I'm giving you sort of a broad general question here, if that's
I like it.
Comments there.
I would say that all rights come with a price, and the price is personal responsibility. And when individuals in the society fail to exercise personal responsibility, they lose their rights. And that's what's been happening in the American police state. People are often dangerous, polluting, thieving, disobedient, et cetera. And this causes the rise of the police state. The police state is the natural response to a very disobedient society. That is incredibly dangerous. A society that allows companies like Monsanto to exist and that allows a military-industrial complex to exist. And so I think that on a practical level, we have to start going back to our roots. You know, according to the Bible, our natural rights and abilities are given to us and can be taken away by our Heavenly Father. I think that's the most practical statement you can make on this topic, and that's a great frame of reference for how to conduct your life. That, you know, these are natural rights; they're given to you from the Father, and that these rights can be taken away when you transgress or when you sin. And some people obviously would not prefer to think in those terms. They would much prefer to think in secular terms. So, you know, they would be more drawn to a scholar like Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago, where he says that, you know, and he comes to the same conclusion. You know, it's that natural law is not an intellectual fiction. It has its basis in civil law and criminal law throughout history. It explains our common values, how, you know, humans have over time our need for food and shelter and justice, and that's where natural laws come from. And that's why you can't make a law against someone having blue eyes or being, you know, natural. You can't make a law where every newborn immediately gets a needle right in their forehead or a chip right in their forehead. You just can't do it. It's against the law. It's against natural law. And the moment that we and if we can't rally around that as a society, you know, if we can't all agree on that, gosh, I don't even know. I mean, fighting so with a human.
We deserve what we get, you know? if we let it happen, you know, I guess. Though disturbingly, there are plenty of us who would disagree. And this is sort of what I feel, you know, in one degree or another, though, is happening, you know, recently and as we speak, Greg, that things are unfolding on multiple levels. It's the old, I mean, some of it really is, I think, covert. You know, if some of the recent tragedies and highly publicized tragedies in the U.S. are really false flag operations, there certainly are people in the alternative media who are screaming those claims and pointing to different types and qualities of evidence to support it, but it goes, for purposes of most people in the U.S., it goes under the radar. But there are other things that are happening, you know, that are hiding in plain sight. And that is things like the passing of laws around the U.S. restricting the access to vaccine exemptions, for example, and some of those laws, in my opinion, doing so in a way that is either unconstitutional or blatantly unconstitutional, depending on the particular instance. But in other words, in some cases, I don't see how the legislators could not know that it was unconstitutional unless they are just completely ignorant about the Constitution, but in other instances, you wouldn't necessarily know it because it's a more subtle argument. But either way, I don't understand why every state legislature does not have its own constitutional filter. You know, no law should even be coming up for vote in a state or federal legislature until it's gotten through the constitutional committee that gives it going over with a fine-tooth comb to see if there are any serious constitutional issues raised by that bill. And if there are, you don't bring it up for a vote. You either scrap it or send it back to committee or somebody to rewrite it. But that appears not to be something that exists in any legislature that I'm aware of, because
I highly checked and balances. Because it's the judiciary's job to put the check on, the constitutional check. And if you had a constitutional committee within the legislature that was checking itself, it would prevent the right of the people to try to enact law or try to change law, which is itself a fundamental right, the right to try to change law.
So you think that's a judicial function that would be improper for the legislature?
Yeah, I think ultimately if there was a state that experimented with that and they tried to have a constitutional committee that prevented the legislature from voting on any law that didn't pass through the committee, I think that committee would be held to be unconstitutional because it would be usurping the judiciary's function and depriving the right of the people.
Yeah, that's a real interesting response. Do you think it would be valid for a legislature to pass a law setting up a judicial committee or judicial function? Could the legislature create a judicial function to do that as a judicial function, do you think? Not that they would.
I think the provision you could do would be that the legislature first off, you set up the committee, the Constitutional Review Committee, and then any law that is deemed to be unconstitutional by the committee gets referred not to the legislature to vote on, but rather to the people to vote on, and only the people can pass it. And then even if the people do pass it, then, of course, the courts can still strike you down as being unconstitutional. I think that would pass muster.
You may have just answered my next question, but the question I have is, and we got to go to another break here shortly, but my question is, state representatives all over the country take an oath to uphold the state and federal constitution. But in terms of whether they're going to vote on a bill or not, or introduce or support a bill, does that oath really have any meaning if there's not some way that in order for that oath to have some practical meaning in terms of practical application, in other words, if they're going to actually ever pay attention to that oath any other time again after they take it to start functioning as a state representative, wouldn't there have to be some system for check and balance other than the one currently in place, which is you pass a law for whatever reason you pass it, political or whatever, even if you know it wouldn't hold up to constitutional scrutiny, you do it anyway because that's what you want to do, and then later if the court strikes it down, so be it. But the problem with the current system is that they take an oath, but the oath can be literally completely devoid of any meaning because they can pass any law they want to, whether it's one that's constitutional or not. And so, you know, what would we have to do to make that oath meaningful in a concrete or tangible way? And maybe what you just said was answering the question, but I guess I wanted to voice the question anyway.
It's an interesting question. I think that if we focus on the oath, we lose the constitutional battle, and that sometimes you have to have bad laws that get written, and then when those laws get stricken down, you know what you have? Good law. And it's only because we have a bad law that was struck down that we are so admired by the rest of the world for our constitutional doctrines. It's like, you know, the rest of the world is even more deferential to the state than the United States government. So you find these cases that become the envy of people all over the world because they say, wow, look at all, you know, this massive court system that has developed to challenge these cases. I mean, these are very freedom-loving people. And it would really just be looked at as an abnormality. They'd be like, oh, look at this freedom-loving people of Fiji. You know, but the fact is that America has massive wealth. And so it's like these are the freedom-loving people of the most, you know, most inventive and wealthy culture that's ever, you know, hit North America. And this is, you know, theory, of course. But, so I think, you know, it's from a historical perspective, the answer is you just let the legislature pass these bad laws. And then when they get overrun, when they get overturned, then the system functions. And then, you know, sometimes things need to run their course like that. You know, like the body, for example. Sometimes you need to have bacteria that comes in, and then so that you can develop the good kind of bacteria to shut it down. And then you're now a functioning system, but only because you have checks and balances. If you completely shut yourself off from bacteria, you would actually be weaker, as you can see with people who live in bubbles. Their immune systems are terrible because they don't know how to end corruption. They don't know how to strike down, you know, bacteria, strike down bad cases.
Well, I really like the theory there, but I do want to point out that the practical shortcoming of that is that lots of people there are lots of people all over the country, for example, in the alternative vaccine community who would support my position that the North Carolina or California laws are unconstitutional. That allow children to consent to vaccines, but so far none of them have figured out a way or taken on the task of getting it in court to test it. And so I'm not sure that the system is reasonably accessible if so many people can have an objection to it, but nobody is really doing anything to exercise the system, to bring the system to bear on it. And I hope we can do that in both California and North Carolina in the near future. But let me take a couple minutes here and do a break. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips and special monthly guest Attorney Greg Glazer from California. And we're going to take a few minutes here to hear some information about some of the other shows on Freedomizer Radio. There are a number of different shows that run from early morning to late at night throughout the week and through the weekend, and we hope that you'll go to freedomizerradio.com to look at some of the different shows. But I'll play some ads here where we give ourselves a break, and we will be back in just a few minutes. And, Greg, just to give you a heads up, the last 4 minutes of the hour, I will play the Destiny Freedom song, and that gives our next show host time to plug into the system after I have plugged out but leave the music running. So just so you'll know in terms of the time frame what we're heading for in a few minutes here. Folks, stay with us. We've got lots more. Let me verify, Greg, can you stay with us for the next half hour?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry I didn't officially check that. I'm delighted to have that. Normally the last half hour would be Debbie Bruck from Homeopathy World Community talking to you about homeopathy, and we certainly miss having Debbie to talk to us today about that, but I believe she'll be back next week. And we have the great privilege and pleasure then of having Greg with us for an extra half an hour, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with that.
We are Critical Immunity with Larry and Renee. Our show will cover current events, national health news, nutrition, emergency preparedness, and organic farming, and various implements and tools to thrive and survive. We hope you tune in and join in our discussion of health, liberty, preparedness, and survival. Join our hosts, Larry and Renee, with guest callers always welcome.
We know about the Gulf oil spill. We know about problems with voting. We know about environmental toxicity. We know that there are problems about the wars, that our government is not representing the people as we would wish them to represent us. But we also know that there are crystal clear solutions. I'm Patricia Springstead, and I'm heavily involved in making the world a better place.
Every day you try to brainwash people just to have things go.
Trisha Springstead on Freedomizer Radio. Crystal Clear Solutions.
Well, tell me what you're gonna do when you're well and dry.
Oh, you want to heal the world? Oh, you can't do that. You know, you gotta elect the right people. No, change your thinking. Change the way you feel. Change the way you do things. Do everything for peace. Like John Lennon said, walk for peace. You take a shower for peace. Do whatever you do for peace.
Every time you do that, you set a ripple effect out.
Because we live in a vibrational world, and your brain is the instrument. To learn how to direct and control your mind, you guys are superheroes. You know, they don't want you to know that, but you are. You guys are the most powerful people in the world.
We see the power in you to change your thinking. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Roar! Welcome to Crazy Dragon's Den with your hostess, Tammy, the Crazy Canadian, here on FreedomizerRadio.com. Join me in the den Mondays and Wednesdays, 11 to 12 Pacific Standard Time, 2 to 3 Eastern Standard Time. Mondays are a double whammy from your crazy Canadian Tammy, because from 3 to 5 Pacific Standard Time, 6 to 8 Eastern Standard Time, my sidekick David makes his appearance, and we discuss a little of this and a little of that. We'll question things that make you go, and maybe find some answers. So join me Mondays and Wednesdays at FreedomizerRadio.com. To listen to my show live, you can call in to vent your roar or join our chat room to drop a comment or question. So join me, Tammy, the Crazy Canadian, on Crazy Dragon's Den here on FreedomizerRadio.com.
Greetings, this is Blake the Eccentric, and I want to invite you to check out my new show on Freedomizer Radio, The Eccentric Perspective. It's sort of a red pill, blue pill, going down the rabbit hole kind of show, featuring outside-the-box politics, philosophy, and gonzo journalism. But be warned, with knowledge comes responsibility, and you might not see the world the same way again. As I will attempt to open your mind, speak to your common sense, and challenge your critical thinking skills. So please join me Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday from noon to 1:30 Pacific Time. Once again, that's Eccentric Perspective, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Okay, we're back with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips, special monthly guest, Attorney Greg Glazer. Greg, we have something on the order of 15 minutes or so here, and I wondered if you would take a minute to let people know where they could get a hold of you, if they may get a hold of you, and if they have follow-up questions, or tell us what you got going on the web that people can look at or participate in.
Yeah. The best way to interact with me is on civilactionnetwork.org. This is a website I created to promote referendum, where people can write proposed laws. I see a lot of people ranting these days about stuff, and it's time to put the rubber to the road and make a proposed law. Other people can vote on your proposals, and it's a very interesting website, civilactionnetwork.org.
Civilactionnetwork.org. Okay, folks, so you heard it. I encourage you to go to civilactionnetwork.org. Greg is a wealth of information, ideas, and knowledge. Always love having you on the show, Greg, and invite others to interact with you as well. I don't want to keep it all to myself here. So, okay, what can we get into in the last few minutes here?
Well, how about if we chat about the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts?
This is such a fundamental case for the vaccine issue. It's often referred to as the seminal vaccine case. And was there anything specific about Jacobson you want to get into? Because I tell you what, let me raise one point, and feel free to steer this in another direction. But Jacobson was a case about it was a 1905 U.S. Supreme Court case, and it was a case about a man who decided he did not want to get the smallpox vaccine because he had had a bad reaction to it as a child, and he was asserting the position that he has a constitutional right to decide what goes into his body, and he says no. And the fine at that time for not getting the vaccine was exorbitant. It was, what, $5, I think, which would be, what, $500,000 today? But no, it sounds funny to read about an old case for $5. $5? Geez, I'll pay $5 not to get a vaccine. But, you know, in that day, it was considerably a bigger number than the number 5 is today with dollars. But what bothers me, I think, most about Jacobson historically over time is that it seemed to me that one could read Jacobson as being a case about whether or not you have a right to refuse vaccines in an emergency. And yet Jacobson seems to me, and by all means tell me if you have a different understanding, Greg, I'll defer to your research expertise on the point, but it seems to me that Jacobson has been just interpreted much more broadly over the years by other courts since then as sort of a basis for saying that outside of an emergency context, you can be required to get a vaccine, and then is what has happened all over the U.S., not just with kids in school, but with people in the military, immigrants, at least the legal ones, have to get vaccines, and vaccines are now starting to show up in state laws around the country that are requiring healthcare workers, although hospitals all over the country are mandating flu shots for healthcare workers, whether the state also mandates it or not. But we're seeing the states pick up the ball on this one and run with it. There's just more and more vaccines being required all over the place. And my understanding of Jacobson is that if he would have had a medical doctor saying at that time, you know, right now you are not a fit subject for vaccination, he might have been able to get out of it. But since his objection was that he had had a reaction many years in the past as a child, they were saying, well, that doesn't mean you're not a fit subject now for vaccination. So please, first of all, tell me, Greg, if I'm understanding Jacobson right as you read it, and what thoughts do you have any about that? And if I've gone in a total different direction than what you wanted to go, feel free to steer it where you'd like to take it.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, the court in Jacobson recognized that this petitioner, who is a preacher from Massachusetts, could challenge the law on the grounds that he was an unfit subject for vaccination. So the court left open the question of individuals challenging it, whether they, so if you present a doctor's report that says, you know, if you take this vaccination, it's going to, you know, cause you death or something like that, then, you know, you'd be a fit candidate for exemption. So they left that door open. And just as you pointed out, Alan, this is a case from 1905 that has been interpreted today by various powers to support compulsory vaccination. And it's one of those cases that has many interesting quotes that you can just kind of pull right out of context or put them into context depending on how you want to read the case and use it to justify your argument. So it's kind of dangerous like that. And it's a seminal case because nobody challenges it. It's stood the test of time since 1905, even though other cases that cited it were ultimately overruled, like a famous case by Justice Holmes where there was a woman who was mentally retarded, and the state wanted to forcefully sterilize her so she couldn't have any more children. And the Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court justice, said, "The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles are enough," close quote. So that was in 1927, and the Buck case, that case was ultimately overruled, but Jacobson still stood, and legal scholars today will still cite Jacobson on the argument that it allows for compulsory vaccination, even though when you actually read the Jacobson case, it doesn't specifically say that. It's like, it's very particular. You have to use it in the right context. Like, for example, the court used a legal scrutiny that said that they were only going to see if the law was rational. But today, there's a heightened scrutiny. They'd say, well, is the law supported by a compelling reason, and is it narrowly tailored? And then another thing is that the court left open the question of whether a person does have an absolute right to resist vaccination. Because in the Jacobson case, it was a local order. It was this preacher, if he wanted to live in Massachusetts, I mean, if he wanted to live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, he had to either pay $5 or take the vaccination. So he had multiple options. He could either leave the jurisdiction or he'd just pay $5 and not have to get the vaccination. So they never looked at forced vaccination. So, for example, like an order from the United States government that says, you know, everyone has to have this, or you go into quarantine, you know, or will force it on you, you know, or it's a crime or something. That's totally different because then you can't just, you know, buy your way out of it. You can't, you know, leave the jurisdiction. I mean, where else are you going to go, right? It's a national issue. So that never came up. And then the way that the court in Jacobson justified their decision is they did it by analogy because I think the court was troubled by it. The idea that they could force this medical treatment on somebody, you know, one size fits all medicine, right? So, but the way they justified it was by looking at the draft, the military draft, and the judge said, if it's the same principle that can compel a person during times of war to go into the service of his military, that principle also extends to an emergency like a war on the home front, where upon the principle of self-defense, of paramount necessity, a community has the right to protect itself against an epidemic of disease which threatens the safety of its members. Close quote. So now, doesn't that sound like that's at odds with the Syracuse principles that I read earlier? That even if a community doesn't have the right to protect itself, again, a person exercising their natural freedom. It's that if a person is just being totally peacefully natural, then there's no law that can justify taking that away from them, even the life of the nation. And so it seems like the Syracuse principles are at odds with Jacobson. But in any
let me ask you a clarification point here, because if someone I'm trying to figure out how to phrase the question here. I mean, I would presume that someone who is even passively putting someone else at risk in terms of infectious disease, that that's not really peacefully natural in the way that you would define it. In other words, it is possible for someone like a Jacobson who says, I don't want to get vaccinated, but depending on whether they are quarantined or self-quarantining or leaving the jurisdiction or not, that they might hypothetically in an infectious disease situation pose a risk to other people. And so I just wanted, I guess, clarify that I don't think what you're saying, but correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think what you're saying is that a person has a right just absolutely to refuse a vaccine no matter what, but that they have the right to be free from being forced to vaccinate, but that might mean that they have to leave the area or quarantine or do something else. Am I correct
right.
on that? Okay, I just wanted to make sure that I was understanding that point.
For example, if you read the Congressional Research Service, their interpretation of laws across the country, and again, this is state law, so they're taking the consensus of states, it's that if there's an emergency, a pandemic declared by the governor, and you are a citizen who resists a public health order, then you can be taken into quarantine or isolation for resisting. And but currently, if there's no emergency, then you can just submit your exemption. And your exemption means that, you know, based on a religious reason or a philosophical reason, you are saying that you don't want vaccination. And the particular person who receives your exemption form will respect that. And you try to conduct your affairs in such a way that you don't need it. Like, for example, you know, avoiding military service, avoiding working in the hospital. It's getting more and more difficult to assert these exemptions. It's like the greater the fear, the more that exemptions get challenged, even though the law in support of exemptions is very strict. So what I found, looking at this Jacobson case, you know, which is always cited for the ability of the government to force vaccination, I found all these exceptions, you know, that Jacobson doesn't necessarily apply to many situations because, you know, again, it was you could either pay $5 or leave Cambridge. You know, that's totally different than a national order. So, like, for example, here's a quote directly from the Jacobson court. They say, quote, "There is, of course, a sphere within which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightfully dispute the authority of any human government, especially of any free government existing under written constitution, to interfere with the exercise of that will," close quote. So that's the court, Supreme Court, citing natural law. They're saying that there's some things government just can't do, that the supremacy of the individual's will trumps any government order. But now in that same case, you know, the judge is also saying that you can be called to take up arms in defense of your country. Yeah, and so there's a political aspect to these cases. It's that, you know, the court at the time, you know, they looked at public opinion and they thought, well, you know, yeah, you can have a forced draft, you know, and it looks like here you can have, you know, people were very scared at the time of these diseases. You can have a forced public health measure. And so, you know, I think what courts do is they look at the competing values and they try to make a decision. My opinion is that you cannot force someone to pick up a gun, and you cannot force someone to receive a medical treatment. You have to let people be peacefully natural. Now, if a person who is infected with a contagious disease walks into the public square, I think that's a different situation because then they're posing material threat to somebody else. But if you have a person who has potentially an infectious disease and they're just self-quarantining on their own private property, not interacting with anyone else, I mean, that's probably just a naturalist you know, a frightened naturalist who doesn't want to be hunted down by members of his own species. And so the best thing for a society to do is to respect that. And there are many legal scholars out there who are calling for the right to self-quarantine. For example, Wendy Mariner is calling for it, George Annis. These are very well-respected legal scholars who write law review articles in public health. And they are calling for this right to self-quarantine. And so at the state level, though, this right is not well articulated. It's recognized, but it's not well articulated, which means that...
Yeah, in fact, to the contrary, that laws seem to give the state the authority to decide when and where to quarantine you. But
exactly.
we're down to the last few moments here, Greg, and excuse me for sort of cutting in and cutting you off there, but I wanted to make sure I got in a big... full-hearted thank you for your time and extended time today, and it's always fascinating. Let's come back. There is so much more we could talk about Jacobson, and I hope that you'll, when you come back next month, if you don't have something else to fill our plate with, that we can follow up on that, because there are lots of things I'd like to talk about that there. You've been listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips and special guest, monthly guest, Attorney Greg Glazer from California. We are here every Thursday from 1 to 3 Eastern Time, 1 to 3 in the afternoon Eastern Time, and we'll be back next week, and Debbie Brook of Homeopathy World Community hopefully will be back with us as well for the last half hour of the show to talk to you about homeopathy. It's been great, Greg. Thanks for being here. Hope to see you again real soon.
Thanks, Alan.
Across this land, both near and far, throughout the human race, within each beating heart, there is a dream whose time has come for us to claim our birthright. Evil hands have intervened, controlling from the shadows, think they can't be seen. But we have eyes, see in the dark, to cast a light upon the madness we embark. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand of the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Upon their face, sincerity, while underneath the self-agenda does proceed. But falsity perfumes the air, the sense screams louder than the finest ever dare. They'll fill your place with GMOs, and soon your lineage will never cease to grow. Inject your blood with toxic waste. The world is all that bears if you'll just die in haste. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must. souls be the masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny.